Welcome back to another segment of Prayer in the Air. With us, a wonderfully accomplished gentleman. And anytime you tune into TV's news, you often see him commenting on very high-profile cases. I'm speaking of Dr. Cyril H. Wecht. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Mr. Barron.
Dr. Wecht is a forensic pathologist, attorney, and medical and legal consultant. And the list of cases you've been involved with is nothing less than very impressive. May I indulge a little here?
Well, go ahead, sure.
President Kennedy, the assassination of Senator Kennedy, the death of Elvis Presley, O.J. Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey case. Maybe it's easier to list the cases you haven't been involved in.
Well, there's a lot more. Tammy Wynette, Klaus von Bülow, Waco Branch Davidian Fire, Mary Jo Kopechne, Lacey Peterson, Drew Peterson, Michael Jackson, Phil Spector, Anna Nicole Smith and her son Daniel Smith. So, I've had the opportunity to deal with these cases, all of which are quite fascinating. And, of course, when you have controversies involving notorious individuals, celebrities, or so on, then that makes the involvement much more exciting. And provocative.
Now, keeping in mind that the listeners of our program perhaps have lost a loved one, very recently, and they're visiting one of our participating cemeteries or funeral homes or possibly even listening on the internet. So for some of them, they may not be thinking of their own particular cases, fascinating but heart-wrenching. And of course, one of the topics that we are talking about today, and we've invited you, Doctor, to join us on the discussion, is DUI.
Yes.
And in particular, maybe a little glimmer of hope. The Highway Traffic Administration suggests that DUI instances are actually on the decline. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I have been pleased to note that now, over the years, the incidence is declining, and the incidence of motor vehicular accidents and fatal accidents is declining. That is a wonderful thing. And everybody, governmental, private group organizations that have contributed to the educational processes deserve credit. There's still a long way to go. Right. I just returned recently with my family from a two-week visit to Norway, my wife's native country, and I'll use that as a classic example. They don't fool around, and everybody knows if you drink, then you don't drive, and they do designated drivers. They go out for the evening to parties, and Norwegians do like to drink, but they know that the driver is not going to be doing any drinking. Maybe he'll nurse a beer or a glass of wine, and that is it. We have to reach that point in the United States. You do not drive when you drink.
Right, right. I'm an eternal optimist. I like to always believe in the good faith of people and that their intentions are always good. So I've had this notion, as naive as it may be, that DUI actors may not necessarily make the conscious decision to get behind the wheel drunk. Maybe they don't realize that they are so intoxicated. How do you feel about that?
Well, of course, they do not give the degree of conscious awareness, do not undertake the sensitive and perceptive approach that a reasonably intelligent person should be expected to have. Of course, none of these things are done deliberately except in rare, rare occasions, and that's another matter, people who are mentally ill or whatever. But people think that they can drive, that their driving capabilities will not be compromised in any way, motor coordination, sensory perception by drinking, that they can handle it, and so on. And of course, in many instances, people drink and there may not be someone else as a designated driver. Mm-hmm. They put themselves at risk and other people at risk by drinking somewhere at a party, a bar, a restaurant, and not having anybody to drive with them. So that's something that must be borne in mind. If you're going out for a good time and that's your decision, then you've got to make sure you have a way of getting home with somebody else, either in your car or that other person's car.
Right. How many times I've had a cocktail at a restaurant or a party, and I don't feel anything different until I actually get up, and then I realize, wow, okay, yeah, I guess that did have an impact on me. And I'm just wondering if that delayed effect also exists between the time that you get behind the wheel and you start to drive, and all of a sudden it kicks in. Is there any fact to that?
Well, there's a delayed effect, both, shall we say, from a behavioral psychological standpoint, as well as from a physiological standpoint. Physiologically, depending on how much food you have in your stomach, the alcohol is going to be absorbed in anywhere from 20 minutes or so on an empty stomach to 40 to 60 minutes on a full stomach. So if you're having a big meal and you're drinking, then yes, there is an explanation for the fact that you may not feel drunk because two or three drinks have yet to be fully absorbed. So that indeed can make a difference. If, on the other hand, it's not a matter of absorption being drawn out, prolonged because of a stomach full of food, then it's a matter simply you're sitting there and you're talking in a jovial social setting with friends or colleagues, etc. And then when you get up and begin to do things, and especially things such as driving that do require some degree of coordination and perception, then the compromise kicks in. That's something to be borne in mind. Sitting and talking is one thing. Getting into the car and driving is another.
Okay, I understand that. Now, there are a lot of folks that say, oh, I can drink a lot before it starts to affect me. And then there's my wife who has one glass of wine and she's out like a light. So it's hard, I would think, to create some kind of a standard. But can there be a rule of thumb that either bartenders can use or individuals can use that they might be able to determine if I've had one drink, I should wait X number of minutes, or two drinks, wait an additional? Can you give us any kind of guidelines at all?
Well, let me say, there is truth and scientific validity to the belief that people handle alcoholic beverages differently. There's no question. I happen to be I'm not a drinker, and I'm not boasting of that. In fact, you know, when I see my kids enjoying a beer or my wife enjoying a glass of wine, I'm somewhat envious. I would like to be able to share that enjoyable moment. It's just a matter of taste. Mm-hmm. But the point I want to make is, if I were to drink one or two beers or one or two glasses of wine, I know that it would knock me for a loop. On the other hand, if you have someone who has been drinking for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, there's no question that they develop some degree of tolerance and handle it much better. On the other hand, how the body handles things in terms of your psychological, social reactions, behavior is one thing. How the alcohol is playing out on the brain is another, and the alcohol is playing out on the brain. As far as parameters are concerned, look, you can relate it first to the law. The legal limit for driving in Pennsylvania and in, I think, most, if not all other states is a 0.08. Years ago, it used to be 0.15. Then it was lowered to 0.10, and it's been lowered to 0.08. In many countries of the world, it's down to 0.05. And that's where I think it should be, by the way. Okay. All right, so an ounce of 100-proof whiskey, a 12-ounce bottle of beer, a 4-5-ounce glass of wine is going to give you about a 0.025, roughly, average build, a little bit less for someone who is only 100 pounds, and a little bit more for someone is 250 pounds. But let's just use that as an average.
Okay.
So you can see four drinks are going to get you above the 0.008 level. Now, you do have some dissipation. Alcohol is metabolized in the body at a minimum rate generally of 0.015 per hour. 0.015 per hour. So if you're drinking, let's say, four drinks, but it is over a period of 4 hours at a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a celebration, then you are going to be metabolizing the alcohol. So let's say it's a 4-hour event. You could have your four beers or your four glasses of wine or your four mixed drinks, because you will have metabolized 0.06, and the four drinks would have taken you up to a 0.10 over the level, but the metabolism would have been about 0.06, and that brings you down well below the 0.008 level. You see what I mean? So a fast drinking, short period of time, without opportunity for the body to metabolize, is not going to get you down to a safe level. And I'm not suggesting that you just go and have 3-4 drinks, but I do want to make it clear that if it's a prolonged family event and you're going to be there for 4 hours and your drinking is taking place over that period of 4 hours, you know, you're going to be okay as far as the law is concerned. Now, that's the law, but that's different from the body. That doesn't mean that just because you have a 0.07, which is a little bit less than the legal limit of 0.08, that doesn't mean that you are not compromised. 0.07 will also produce some degree of diminution, some dulling of the reflexes. Then it depends on the situation. If it's routine driving and you're watching yourself and there's no big traffic and nothing occurs of an abrupt, unexpected nature, that's one thing. But a child darting across the road, some other driver not paying careful attention, you having to make an emergency stop, you know, any kind of a situation like that, then your reflexes are going to be dulled. I don't care how much of a veteran drinker you are, 2-3 drinks is going to have some compromising effect. So the best and the safest way, as I repeat, is no more than 1 or 2 drinks when you're going to be driving, and the best thing is to have someone else do the driving and you enjoy yourself then. Look at Pittsburgh Steeler player Hines Ward. Yep. Down in Georgia recently. I mean, this is a multimillionaire, so on. He was at a party, guy like that. He could have friends. My God, he could hire somebody. People would have paid him, gotten his autograph, and been happy to drive him home. You know, so that's just not thinking clearly, not using your head wisely to drive after you've been drinking.
Isn't that the truth? I would think that if you consider all of the cases that you have examined over the years, over your career, that the stories are quite unbelievable, and I would even cringe to hear them. But, and certainly some of our listeners, you know, may in fact have experienced on a secondary level the effect of those kinds of traumatic cases. So one might think or want to believe that, okay, maybe at the moment of impact, they were spared the pain. And the reason I think this at all is because from the interviews that I've had of people who have recovered from an incident or an accident, when you ask them commonly, do they remember the moment of impact, they'll say, no, you know, I don't remember what happened. So is it possible, or is there any kind of scientific evidence that consciousness might somehow suspend right before the moment of impact? Is that possible?
Well, I think some of that, frankly, is of a psychological nature. It is natural for us as human beings to repress memories of an unpleasant nature and to repress things that make us feel guilty and so on. This isn't done at a conscious level. I'm not talking about a premeditated, calculated prevarication and so on, but the brain kicks in to protect us. If we did not have that, the incidence of suicide would be much, much higher, and I say that not glibly, but quite seriously. So it is natural, and it is indeed a wonderful mechanism that we have, that we kind of repress things that would make us feel terribly guilty. And that is, I think, the major reason why people say they just don't remember, because if they were driving, assuming that they weren't so stoned as not to remember anything, but they remember they were at the ABC restaurant, and they remember whom they were with and what the occasion was, and they know exactly when they left, when they drove, and where they were going, and then they say, gee, I just don't remember what happened at the moment of impact. Now, what they may mean is they don't remember exactly what happened. That can be a child darting out, a deer crossing the road, causing you to veer across the center line into another car. Yeah, sure, that kind of thing is understandable. You just don't really know exactly what happened. But if they're driving, then they go through a red light, or they go through a stop sign, or they cross the center line or so on, to say later on, you know, they just don't remember what happened, I think really is a matter of subconscious repression, of a feeling of remorse and guilt for the damage and harm they did to others and even to themselves.
So the brain kicks in and helps out a little bit here.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the next thing that I think, for example, the movie Back to the Future, where the two main actors were in the Western genre, and they were trying to sober up before they had to go out and meet, you know, their nemesis on the street with a gunslinging action there. So one of them had to take large sums of coffee, and they added hot sauce and so on to try to sober him up. Does any of that really work?
Well, if you take your caffeine or other stimulants, let's say amphetamines or so on, They are so-called upper central nervous system stimulants, whereas ethanol alcohol is a central nervous system depressant, although people think that it really is a stimulant because some people who tend to be silent and quiet become socially gregarious, begin to tell jokes and so on, and behave in a manner that they don't customarily engage in. They think alcohol is a stimulant. It is not. It may, what it's doing is repressing that part of the brain that in some people causes them to be a very quiet, passive individual. But from a pharmacological, neurophysiological standpoint, alcohol is a depressant, and therefore anything which is a stimulant counteracts that. However, it's not like a direct antidote. It's not, for example, somebody gets bitten by a snake and you give him anti-venom injection and it acts directly on that. The caffeine does not wipe out the alcohol. It may make you certainly somewhat more alert, yes, but the idea that, well, I'll drink a couple of cups of black coffee in as much as I was drinking and that will negate the influence of the alcohol and I will be okay, that is fallacious reasoning. It does not work that way. It may make you feel more stimulated. It may make you feel more awake, but it has not gotten rid of the alcohol. It does not, in a chemical way, lead to a reduction of the alcohol. The alcohol is still in your system.
But it might actually help you, though?
Oh, yeah. You know, I would recommend it, sure. I think that it certainly can stimulate you and make you more alert. So if you have been doing some drinking and so on, sure. Wind up the evening with a cup of black coffee. Yeah, well, sure. That is something. Or run around the block and make sure you're fully awake. All of that is good. It'll contribute to an increased degree of mental acuity. But I just want to point out that it is not eliminating alcohol from your system.
How about the hot sauce?
hot well, hot foods and Mexican type foods and things like that, Thai foods, what have you. Sure, they fall into the same category. That which will stimulate and make you more alert. It might be a burning of the tongue, you know, whatever, a little reflux aggravation in your gut.
Another thing of concern, of course, is those folks who are on prescription drugs or perhaps over-the-counter drugs, and how combination of drugs can in some
very,
ways...
Very, very important. It cannot be stressed. I do over 300 autopsies a year for coroners in four surrounding counties. Of those 300 coroner's cases, at least a third involve a combination of drugs. These are not people who are committing suicide or who are being murdered. These are people who are taking 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 drugs at the same time, and about half of them, alcohol will be one of those drugs. The answer to this question is very simple, but it cannot be overstated. It cannot be repeated too often. When you are taking any of the drugs that depress the brain, you don't want to drink. As I say, you want to nurse a bottle of beer, glass of wine, fine. But beyond that, no. And here I'm talking about all of the painkillers, analgesics, all of the antidepressants, all of the anti-anxiety drugs, all of the tranquilizers, and all of the sedatives. So any painkillers, all of the opioids, morphine, Demerol, fentanyl, methadone, oxycodone, oxycontin, hydrocodone, all of those drugs, and then all of the tranquilizers, the Xanax and Ambien, and all of the antidepressants, Wellbutrin and Zoloft, and all of the sedatives, the barbiturates, and so on. If you're taking those drugs, and so many people are, you do not want to drink. And this goes beyond just driving. Obviously, driving a vehicle makes it even worse. But I cannot stress, and I'm not saying this to scare people, I'm giving you hard facts. 25 to 35% of deaths being handled by medical examiners and coroners in the United States of America today involve people who have died as a result of multiple drugs. Acute combined drug toxicity is the diagnosis I use. Acute combined drug toxicity. And sometimes 7, 8 drugs, the average being 4 and 5, I see when I get the toxicological analyses sent back to me from the laboratory.
This isn't just prescription drugs either, is it? It's over the
over-the-counter, mostly, too. Mostly prescription drugs. Yes, these are not illicit. Yeah, the illicit drugs of heroin, whether they are obtained illicitly in some instances, by that I mean they're bought, maybe they're stolen, or so on. But I'm talking about prescription drugs. I'm not talking about the old heroin user in a back alley in the middle of the night shooting up. I'm talking about people, white and black, young and old, male and female, rich and poor. You can't believe it just crosses the entire spectrum. And yes, I'm talking about prescription drugs, some that the people get themselves, their neighbors, what have you. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And what about over-the-counter drugs?
Some of them contain some dangerous compounds, including, by the way, as you know, some of the drinks that have been out there that have alcohol, amazingly. But it's amazing that state and federal regulatory agencies have permitted some of those drinks to be on the market. And some of the drugs, some of the cough medications, some of the decongestants, you know, they contain drugs that are central nervous system depressants.
Were you thinking of the 5-hour energy drink by chance when you were trying?
Yeah, some of those, whatever their names are. Yeah, the energy drinks, I guess, is the generic categorical term for them, and they ought to be checked very carefully.
Okay, here's a question. If you happen to witness an accident taking place, and you're just an average, you know, passerby, maybe driving by, maybe walking by, what should you do? Is there anything you could do to help, or is there something maybe you should not do?
Well, it's not for me to tell somebody what to do. These are personal, moral, ethical decisions that individuals make. Certainly, the decent, proper thing to do is to try to render whatever help you can. On the other hand, you know, 95% of people are not going to have any medical, nursing, paramedical, emergency training at all. What can you do? You can try to help somebody, but then you've got to be careful. You know, you may add to the injury in an attempt to be helpful. Someone may have a back neck injury with dislocation of the vertebral column, and you're trying to make them comfortable by moving them or lifting their head, and that may result in more damage to the spinal cord. So, you know, I'm not going to say just go and try to make somebody comfortable, because that could be harmful. Obviously, the first thing to do is to go and see what is there and to block off the scene in any way you can, to place an emergency call. That's the most important thing.
Yes.
Right away, 9/11. What you should not do is you should not just move somebody because you think you're doing the right thing or you're getting them off the road so traffic can move or so on, because moving somebody can aggravate musculoskeletal bony injuries and, most importantly, can aggravate spinal cord injuries. So you don't just move somebody. You've seen ball games and places where they go out there with trainers and so on, and they put solid blocks on each side of the person's neck so that the body cannot be moved, and especially the head upon the neck from the body, in order to avoid that kind of damage. So you've got to be very, very careful. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, it's just, I can't give medical advice of a general categorical nature.
It's always just safe to call 911, get somebody
immediately,
there.
That's what you definitely should do.
Right, right. And just be there if you can, maybe hold their hand?
Well, yeah, sure. That's always comforting, absolutely.
Talk to
them? Absolutely, and you know, to talk to somebody and so on. Now, on the other hand, if you see some area bleeding or so on, it never hurts to apply pressure to a bleeding site. You're not going to harm anything there as long as you're not moving the body. Or to tie a tourniquet, you see a vessel spurting, to tie a tourniquet if it's an arm or a leg above the site of bleeding. That you should do with a belt or a scarf or whatever. You're not going to hurt anything in doing that. But I would say moving the body is something that has to be either refrained from or done with very, very ginger care based upon what the individual tells you he or she is suffering from and feeling, you know, where it hurts, what they can or can't move.
TV producers and movie producers would have us believe that if someone's involved in an automobile accident, that you want to get them out of the car as soon as possible, lest the car burst into flames. Is that true?
Well, that's another matter. If there is an accident and the car is likely to burst into flames, yeah, that's another matter. Then, you know, although you run the risk of maybe aggravating an injury such as I have just described, sure, the greater risk is that the car may get on fire and even explode. So, yeah, I would not fault that reasoning. If there's a serious accident, and especially one involving the front of the car, the motor, and so on, then it would be a wise idea to get the person out of the car because of the fear of an incendiary or an explosive effect.
One last question. If you are yourself in an accident and you feel like you're okay, you want to obviously address the other members of your vehicle to make sure that they're okay and possibly help them if needed. What should you do to be certain that you are able to help? Isn't it possible that you may be injured and you don't even know it?
Sure. Absolutely. And the excitement, the anxiety, the attention of the moment leads to an elevation of blood pressure. The catecholamines, adrenaline-type compounds, pour out in the body and give you increased strength and vigor. Sometimes you can't even believe later on what you were able to accomplish. And in the course of that kind of behavior, you may well not appreciate the fact that you are suffering some injury yourself. So do what you have to do to be helpful, to be sensitive and responsive and so on, but then think of your own injuries and so on. And I would certainly advise people then if they feel they have something that is hurting, something that is producing a problem of an abnormal nature, to go to the nearest emergency room or outpatient clinic and tell the individuals what happened, or ask the police officers to take you to such a facility so that you can be checked out. Yeah, you don't know. Head injuries with slow bleeding can result in death later on. If they're not properly diagnosed, you can have slow bleeding into a chest or abdominal cavity from a ruptured organ, especially like the spleen. That can play out very slowly, and you may feel that there's nothing to worry about, but it is happening, and if you don't take care of it, it may lead to dire consequences. So you should always make sure that you're checked out.
Isn't it a good idea to ask other members of the car or the family to look at yourself, for them to look at you before you get up and move around?
Well, sure. That's a very good idea. Somebody else, right, to see your reaction, to ask you to slowly move your extremities, to follow the finger as they move it, and to make sure that, you know, your vision is there, to ask you your name, who the president is, the date, and so on. Sure, because you yourself may not perceive that your senses have been dulled and that something is happening inside your body, especially with your brain. A very good idea if somebody is there to just to do a little checking out.
We always like to end our interviews on an upbeat if we can, and this has all been such a learning experience, and we've learned so much from you, Doctor, and I hope that you'd agree to come back with us sometime again.
Yes, thank you. It'll be my pleasure.
Is there anything that you can offer, a word of wisdom, a word of hope, to those listeners who might be listening to you right now?
Well, I don't know what more to say without being redundant. I would just say that, you know, people drink, everybody drinks, doctors and lawyers, teachers, priests, rabbis, ministers, so I'm not going to tell people not to drink. My advice is simply think of the fact that, one, alcohol depresses the brain. That means that motor, coordinative, and sensory perceptive skills and abilities are compromised. Think that driving is a dangerous endeavor under the best of circumstances. Think of all the people who are injured and killed each year in motor vehicular accidents, and even more so in home accidents and accidents at work, not just limited to driving, by the way. All the things we've been talking about are applicable to one's behavior and conduct in the home or at work. We might throw that in too. So just behave in a sensible fashion. Do all the drinking you want to drink, but make sure that if you are going to be driving, you have someone else who is going to drive the car on the return trip, and make sure that you don't do the drinking if you're going to be engaging in some kind of dangerous or potentially hazardous activity at the workplace or at your home. Think of other people. If you don't want to think of yourself, think of other people.
And if you find yourself or someone in your family who's been in an accident, know that there are wonderful professionals like you and many others there to help and to do everything you can to ease your pain and to recover.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks again, Dr. Wecht.
All right, thank you, Mr. Barron. My pleasure.